Extra time.
Hello and welcome back to the Extra Time podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten. And this week I'm joined by Doogie Critchley. Hello, Doogie. How are you?
Hi, Pat. Yeah, I'm good, thank you. It's the first time we've actually shot together in quite a while. I'm excited for that. I'm very excited for Christmas as well. It's coming up incredibly fast now. And I feel like a sort of 3-4-year-old. I've never been so excited for Christmas. I think it's after this year, this terrible year we've all had. I just can't wait to get really drunk and eat loads of food.
I completely agree. I haven't really been drinking a lot this year, but I'm kind of looking forward to getting absolutely smashed on Christmas Day.
That's the plan.
And just also like a change of scene. Like, it obviously looks like we're going to be able to go home. And I'm just, Emma and I, when we go for a walk, we always kind of have to do the same one or two walks. If I go for a run around the area, it's the same run.
I'm just
kind of bored. I need to see something different.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, well, I mean, football wise I could also do with seeing something different, but today we're not going to be talking about Arsenal or the mess there. I'm really sorry, but I was going to say you'd have to tweet at me for that, but I don't check my Twitter account anymore, so
off Twitter. I've noticed that, actually. Have you just fallen out of love with Twitter? Actually, you never really liked it that much, did you?
No, I didn't. I got off it like back in, I don't know, like maybe May or something. I was just like, I'm done with this now. I think there was one day, which was the straw that broke the camel's back, where I was just like, I think there were like three things that pissed me off in a row.
Fair.
And two of them were from people I actually knew, rather than just like idiotic stuff kind of retweeted into my timeline. And I was like, you know what, this just makes me too angry. It's
I'm
not
done.
Worth it. Yeah, I'm out. And now, and you know, now sometimes I'm like, oh, I wish I had a Twitter account. And then I'm like, well, what do I actually want to do with my Twitter account? Just bitch about football.
Yeah.
Like, it's not worth it.
I kind of enjoy like the memes, the shit opinions, but I can see why, you know, people would want to spend their time on something else.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I'm still on Instagram vaguely, so, fair. You know, catch me on Instagram. Anyway, should we talk about the situation at Dortmund? That's
yes.
going to be one of our major topics this week, because obviously over the weekend, Dortmund suffered an embarrassing 5-1 loss to newly promoted Stuttgart. But I was shocked that Lucien Favre ended up leaving as a result of this this match, because Lucien Favre, when you look at the table, I was quite surprised to see that Dortmund had already lost 4 league games this season. But they're only 6 points off the top, and it's not like they're 6 points off the top and like Bayern are running away with it. They're 6 points off the top, and as of our time of recording, Bayer Leverkusen are top. So they're totally within reach of the top of the table. The Champions League, they're through as well, as I recall. And generally speaking, they've got quite a good, promising side. Like, they've been getting decent results early days in the season, despite the fact that Jadon Sancho has been in pretty bad form.
Yeah.
And Jude Bellingham is obviously still setting in. Gio Reyna's only just become a starter. It just feels a little bit like this is an odd one. But I wonder if it was maybe mutual, because Lucien Favre had a bit of a record of trying to resign when he was at Gladbach. Dukes, can you make head or tail of this? Because this seems like a really strange one to me.
I was surprised as well, but I think it just goes to show how keen either Dortmund or Favre, I think Dortmund were, to make a change that they haven't even, they've appointed as assistant until the end of the season. It's not like it's not like they were ready to bring in a Pochettino or an Allegri or a Marco Rosa immediately. Like, they were so desperate to get rid of him that they've just gone, oh, we'll just have his assistant to the end of the year. And unless it's some sort of, he's like some sort of Hansi Flick messiah, that I just don't see how it's going to improve the side, which is slightly concerning. And as you say, like, Dortmund actually started the season reasonably well. I think they won maybe 5 of their first 6 games. I think they were level on points with Bayern. Then they lost to Bayern. They've also been beaten by Cologne. And then this loss to Stuttgart at the weekend, I was watching the highlights of it. I mean, it was just atrocious. I think they conceded 3 goals in 11 second half minutes. But they'd actually played all right in the first half there. It was 1-1. Gio Reyna had scored a great goal. Jude Bellingham had one ruled out for offside. But they just completely collapsed. And Stuttgart have some really exciting players. Gonzalez, Koulibaly, this young winger coming through. But the level of implosion was really quite shocking. And as you say, they're only 5 points behind Bayern and Leipzig. But it feels like this year, with the talent that they've got, they could have really put together a pretty good challenge. especially with Bayern looking pretty shaky at points, especially defensively, and massively overperforming their expected goals as well. I mean, I think pretty much everything Bayern are hitting at the moment is going in, which also comes down to the fact they've got exceptional, you know, forward players. But you, that might even out across an entire campaign, and then Dortmund could come into the mix. But as a whole, I'd say Favre's reign was pretty solid, but it was just the defending that's really let them down. I think they've only conceded less than 40 league goals in a single campaign once in the last 6 years. And without the money or the financial resources to bring in the level of attackers that that Bayern have, and they've had to develop their own, and they've done that very well, it was really going to be the defence that was going to make the big difference if they were going to win the league title, because I never think they're going to score more goals than Bayern, effectively. And it just didn't look like Favre was able to introduce a really solid defence, although he has had some injuries there this year. I think Zagadou's missed games, Schultz has missed games, they've had to play Piszczek and Delaney at centre-back at times as well. So I think Dortmund, the hierarchy, were just we're not going where we want to quick enough, and we've got this exceptional crop of young talent that are potentially not going to win what they should with the talent available. So a little bit baffling, but I could kind of see the logic as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are extenuating circumstances, though, I guess, because I think that the Meunier signing has been borne out to be a pretty bad one. I mean, he certainly is not well liked among Dortmund fans, and that's a significant downgrade from Hakimi in that right wing back slot from last season. You know, they've tried Felix Paslak there, who of course has been out on loan the last three seasons. He was on loan with Norwich in the Championship,
and
he couldn't even get a sniff because Max Ahrens was starting every game, and now he's going back and playing games for Dortmund, which kind of shows you that they're a little bit thin on the ground. I mean, plus you've got to think about where Dortmund were when he took over. Like, of course there was a successful Tuchel era, but that ended pretty badly, pretty acrimoniously, and of course there was the bus bombing around that time, which I think really shook the club. Then you had Peter Bosz come in, who put together an extremely, really quite a naive Dortmund side, and lost his job very quickly. And then, really uninspiring, Peter Stöger saw out the rest of that season, and it was just turgid, dull football. And when you compare that to the football they were playing, certainly over the back half of last season after the arrival of Haaland, and this season as well, it feels like they've come on leaps and bounds. Like, Favre isn't known for producing exciting football, but up until this last weekend, Dortmund were actually top in Europe's top five leagues for expected goal difference.
Okay.
And now they're sixth for expected goal difference per 90 because they played far fewer games in other leagues, which is still pretty damn good. They're ahead of Bayern. I think they're just behind Leipzig. So they're rated as the second best team in Germany, the sixth best team in the on the continent. And even when you look at the real goals, only two teams in Germany have scored more. Only three teams have conceded fewer. It just feels like Favre has produced a winning side, a good side. And yes, this is an embarrassing result, but almost nobody has been exempt from an embarrassing result so far this season. You know, even Liverpool have been hammered, and Real Madrid have been hammered.
Absolutely.
And it just feels like it's happening to everyone.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, I think there has been some very strange results. And actually, Dortmund had the best defence in the Bundesliga until, I think, this losing run or their period of losses more recently. And also the development of some of the young players. Like, Sancho was insanely good last year. I think it was 33 league goal contributions. And this year, he just went through an incredible hot streak in about February time last year. I think it was just before lockdown, where he scored in about 10 games in a row. Everything he hit went in, and it was awesome to watch. But did you feel like at whatever he is, 20, that he was going to be able to keep that going for effectively 2 years straight with very little break and with an entire summer of speculation? Like, I think that's quite unrealistic. I mean, only the very, very best, like Mbappe and seemingly Haaland, can keep that form going for 2 years straight at that age. So, I mean, I don't think there's anything too much to worry about in terms of where their attack is, and like you kind of mentioned there, he had to deal with some difficult circumstances in the summer with Hakimi going, who was such a crucial part of that side. And as you say, they've had to play Paslak and Murray even had to play at right wing back this weekend. So it's not exactly like he's been given the same level of financial backing as Bayern, which you'd never expect him to. And I think it's one of those reigns that you look back in 2-3 years' time and be like, he actually made great strides in producing a side that could then consistently challenge. It just may be if the last month has really taken a knock in where Dortmund think they are against where they think they should be this season.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Like, expectations have been raised and then dashed, and that's always a difficult kind of dive to pull out of as a manager. But when you consider the way he's developed these young players, you know, like, you're always going to be a little bit patchy when you're relying on 17-year-olds, and they've got more than one 17-year-old in the squad. I completely agree with you, what you said at the beginning as well, about, like, it seems strange to get rid of Favre now in favour of an assistant. Because the guy taking over is Edin Terzic, who has been Slaven Bilic's assistant, actually. Both at West Ham and at Besiktas, I think. But there are rumours that they are either seeking an agreement with or may already have an agreement with Marco Rosa to come in as manager next summer. Do you think that would be the right choice, do you? Because other names that have been mooted here are Pochettino, Nagelsmann, Ralf Rangnick, and, of course, Jesse Marsh, who's everybody's favourite manager at the moment. What do you think? Is Rosa the right shout? Is there anybody else they should be considering?
I mean,
and is it fair to give the rest of the season to Terzic?
Yeah, I think it's a big ask for Terzic. I mean, with the weird results we've seen so far, and everyone, all the top sides seemingly taking a step down this year, like, I think the top four race in all the big five leagues is going to be more competitive than ever. So Dortmund have to stay in the mix there. And I don't want him to be sort of handed like an impossible... Well, not an impossible job per se, because he's got a lot of talent. But it could go very badly wrong with, you know, Leverkusen, Gladbach playing well, Wolfsburg playing well as well. So there's plenty of... Union Berlin as well. So there's plenty of sides in the mix. In terms of who I want to take over, like, I think the outstanding candidate right now is obviously Pochettino. But whether he'd... I think his wage demands are massive, because I put it on Twitter yesterday and Joe actually responded being like, he's asking for 12 million euros a year, which is why effectively he hasn't got a job so far, or at least that was Joe's sort of thinking. So maybe that wouldn't work, but Pochettino with that Dortmund squad would be awesome. I think he maybe is looking for a job where he is, you know, more guaranteed trophies, if that makes sense. Like, I think he's looking for a Real Madrid, you know, I was about to say Man United, that's far from a guarantee, maybe a Man City at some stage as well. So Pochettino would be difficult to get in. And Marco Rosa, I think, is awesome, to be honest. I think he's the football that his Gladbach side play would work really well with some of Dortmund's players as well. You can swap in, like, Thuram and Alisson Player quite easily for Reina, Sancho, Haaland. He's got more out of Mbolo than any manager has before. Florian Neuhaus in midfields look excellent. Dennis Zakaria has been injured, but he's very good as well. And they've had some inconsistent results in the Champions League, but to get through that group was a massive achievement. So Marco Rosa would be a fantastic managerial appointment in my eyes as well. And then Jesse Marsh as well is a great candidate. Potential Salzburg have really come on leaps and bounds. They're now a regular sort of... They've been handed really difficult Champions League groups. I think last year it was Liverpool and Napoli. This year it was Bayern and Atleti. They haven't matched them in terms of results, and they haven't really got the wins that they should have. But some of their performances have been outstanding. And he's clearly a fantastic coach. So, you know, Dortmund looking into the Red Bull networking or ex-Red Bull networking, going Marco Rosa or Jesse Marsh is a very good place to be shopping. But I think Pochettino would probably be the dream. I just don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, I think that Marco Rosa does seem like the right shout. He can come in, he can adapt pretty quickly. You know, whereas we know that Pochettino obviously had some issues learning English when he came to the Premier League, and you could imagine him struggling again to adapt, maybe.
That's a good point.
It seems like Rosa is kind of... He fits the Dortmund ethos, and so does Marsh. I think one of those two would make the most sense. Like, Rangnick's obviously a great manager, but Rangnick is also... I feel slightly wasted as just a manager. Like, Rangnick is a guy who, like... a club like Arsenal or Man United should pick up and let him both coach the team and run recruitment and just really tear everything down and start again. As we know, Dortmund have got Michael Tork there, who's one of the best directors of football in the world. It seems like Rangnick would potentially not be okay with that dilution of power. So I don't know. Yeah, I think that Marco Rosa seems sensible, but I would definitely have given Favre till the end of the season and just allowed him to see this one out, because I think that Dortmund will probably, well, I don't know now, but I think if they'd kept Favre, they would have been right up there come the end of the season. Maybe not winning the title, but I would still put money on them finishing second.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a disappointing week for Lucien Favre. Back on the job market for him. Just before we move on to our next section, where we're going to be talking about Sheffield United, let's have a quick word from our sponsors. And this week it is Manscaped. Now, if you want a little bit of festive cheer over the new year, then why not treat your balls to some quality grooming products from Manscaped? 2020 was absolute garbage. This could be a way of ending it in style. 2 million men all over the world are helped by Manscaped in their below-the-waist grooming, and they can, of course, help you keep clean for 2021. Well, Dukes, I think we could both agree that 2020 was pretty awful. Like, yeah. I mean, look, I didn't mind the banana bread period. I like banana bread. I think that was fine. I didn't mind not seeing, you know, Chris Hamill. That was also fine. I didn't have an issue with it. It wasn't a problem. I was able to work in quiet at home. But 2020 was a garbage year.
Yeah, I mean, there's no two ways about it. It was dreadful. And also, we've seen like some really big names in the world of culture, world of sport, unfortunately pass away this year. I mean, just this morning, with Gerard Houllier's passed away, which is like devastating news. It was literally about 5 minutes before we started this podcast. Yeah, sorry to land that on you. Obviously, Diego Maradona a couple of weeks ago. It feels like 2020. Kobe Bryant, of course. I'm sure I'm missing out numerous names as well. So it's been a really difficult year for loads of people. And I don't really want to complain too much about my loss. Obviously, it was, you know, a crap year, but compared to a lot of people, not nearly as bad. But yeah, I mean, it's just been a really difficult year for everyone involved. So Manscaped, a little Christmas treat. Get your balls in great shape for 2021. Everyone likes a New Year's resolution. I think this is a way to go to cheer yourself up.
My God, what a tone change. I do think there is something to be said, though, for, you know, like I went and got a haircut this week, and it really, I don't know, it just sort of cheered me up. It made me feel a bit like fresh.
Alive
again. Yeah, and sometimes I do just think you need that feeling of a fresh start, and that's obviously something you can get from seeing friends or seeing family, but you can also get it from like taking care of yourself a bit. Like, we've obviously talked quite a lot, I think all of us, about the exercise we've done in lockdown, but I also think a bit of grooming can help when you haven't worn anything except like joggers for like 3 months. I think it's nice to show yourself a little bit of care, and that's something you can do with Manscaped.
Absolutely.
They've got their perfect package 3.0, has all the right tools to give you a fresh start in 2021. There's the Lawnmower 3.0, which is obviously their trimmer. It's waterproof and skin safe, will reduce nicks to your best friends. And I think you know what I mean by your best friends. You can also use their Crop Preserver, which is an anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer. Seems sensible, given that, you know, you put deodorant on your armpits. I guess it's strange that there's not a convention of putting deodorant on your balls. It's a weird one.
Yeah, true.
How do you feel about that, Diggs?
Having once put deep heat on my balls by accident, I just try and stay clear of anything that could potentially aggravate them, really. So,
yeah. Well, okay, yeah. I mean, that is foolhardy in the extreme to put deep heat on your balls. But maybe you prefer the Crop Reviver ball toner
that
spray.
Sounds better. That sounds better.
Something specially formulated to be kind to your balls rather than turn them into like glowing red rocks.
Yeah, I'm still a bit worried about my fertility, yeah.
Yeah, well, Manscaped will also throw in their shed travel bag to keep all their goodies stored comfortably, and they have anti-chafing boxer briefs included in this package as well. The best underwear you'll ever wear, hands down. If you go to manscaped.com and use the code EXTRATIME, that's block capitals, all one word, EXTRATIME, you can get 20% off and free shipping. Your balls will thank you. Anybody who has to look at your balls will thank you. And Doogie and I will thank you. So make sure that you go and give yourself a treat with Manscaped. 20% off and free shipping with the code EXTRATIME. So from the top of the Bundesliga to the bottom of the Premier League, we have Sheffield United, who sank further into misery this weekend with a 3-0 loss to Southampton on Sunday to sit on just 1 point after 12 games. Now, Doogie, do you know how long it's been since a side was on just 1 point or less, fewer, I guess, after 12 games of a season? in the UK? Do you know what it was?
I'm guessing, because you're asking me, it's got to be... Is it anything to do with Sunderland? Because we've had some tragic starts.
It's not to do with Sunderland. I'm asking you because you're the only guest on the podcast today.
Oh, right. Okay.
But it's only been done... This is only the fourth time in English Football League history it's happened. The previous times were Man United in 1930-31, New Brighton in 1931-32. Okay. I think we all know New Brighton. And Newport County, which was in 1970-71.
Wow.
Unbelievable. It's 50 years ago, Dukes. Sheffield United on 1 point after 12 games. In fact, when you go into last season as well, they've lost 14 of their last 15 league games. Their last win was against Chelsea back in July. Dukes, what is going wrong at Sheffield United?
It's pretty tragic, isn't it? The annoying thing is, like, I feel like the first five or six games of the season, I don't have any stats off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure there was just like one goal margins. They were generally in every game. But yesterday... we're filming this on a Monday morning, was pretty awful against Southampton, to be honest. They offered zero attacking threat. Chris Wilder picked, I think it was six players that can play at centre-back. And when you're looking for a goal, when you're looking for some, you know, chance creation, there was just very, very little. And some of the goals they gave away were so sloppy as well. I mean, Nathan Redmond's, from an attacking point of view, looks great, but Sander Berge doesn't track his runner. There was a bit of a mess for the first one when Che Adams can just sort of volley it into Ramsdale's near post under after Bednarek sort of came off his shoulder. It was just like a bit of a mess. And it looks like, I mean, I've been in this situation with Sunderland quite a few times where if you don't pick up a lot of points in your opening sort of five or six games, the papers start getting on you. You start sort of believing that you are actually a really bad side. And it looks like they are just drained of confidence at the moment. And whereas a month ago I thought that they were playing much better than Fulham and West Brom at that particular time, I now think they're playing by far the worst in the Premier League, even worse than West Brom, which is saying something. So it's a really, really troubling period for them. And it just feels like, in terms of what's gone wrong, it's not anything major, I wouldn't say. I think they overperformed last year, obviously. Dean Henderson made a big difference. He's better than Ramsdale. I don't subscribe to the idea that Ramsdale is awful, like a lot of people do. I just don't think he's as good as Dean Henderson. John Lundstrom's been out. Their strikers are really struggling, as they did last year. And they just haven't really found ways to stay in games. Like, their defence are just conceding far too many goals. I mean, I wish I had some sort of really, you know, great piece of analysis for you on why that is. It's just quite basics. Like, they aren't scoring enough and conceding far too many. And I feel like I can only really see them going down now. And I think there'll be lots of their players are good Championship players, but they're not really ready to make differences in Premier League games. And I think if they sell Sander Berge this summer, they might be able to rebuild and go again for another Championship push. But at the moment, I just really can't see them staying in the division.
No, neither can I. I think that it's probably too far gone now. But I mean, I agree with you about Ramsdale. When you look at their save percentage, it's pretty much league average. If you look at post-shot expected goals, which is where the shot is actually placed, taking that into account with expected goals, they've got 21 against and they've conceded 21. So, I mean, they're exactly where you'd expect them to be, really. On the other hand, I think they paid quite a lot for Ramsdale, and they also paid an awful lot for Ryan Brewster, and he's only made three starts so far. Both he and Oliver Burke are around 0.3 expected goals and assists per game. You cannot afford that sort of slow start when you're a team who are going to kind of struggle. You know, a really interesting thing I read over the weekend, I can't remember where I saw it, but somebody posted up Daniel Farke's end of season review after Norwich were relegated last campaign.
Okay.
And he had a really interesting insight into teams getting promoted from the Championship. He said, when teams get promoted because of a good defence, when they're a solid defensive side, they often have a good first season in the next division because they're still good defensive sides. Mm. And they're able to kind of play on the counter-attack and use set pieces and kind of muddle through. And normally there are worse sides who will go down. Where they struggle is the following season, when they need to expand and develop new ways of scoring goals, because it results in a change of style. It means that they have to make the right signings. And if they don't get those signings right, then they can often be in real trouble. Now, that seems what's happened with Sheffield United. The other side of that was he said teams that come up because of a good attack,
Norwich, I suppose.
And like Villa, they often have real trouble in their first year because they just get torn through by better attacks and they can't have as much danger as they used to pose to the division below. But if they can survive that season, they tend to sort themselves out a little bit at the back, get another couple of signings, and then they're in a much better position to start imposing a more dominant possession style.
Love it, Daniel.
In the upper division.
I think you might have a point there.
I think there's a really, really fascinating insight, and I think Sheffield United are in exactly that situation. You know, last year, we even saw Wolves have a difficult second season in the Premier League. And last year, you know, Sheffield United were the surprise package. You know, they were showing us some things that we hadn't really seen before, which actually now are becoming a little bit more common. You know, the idea of the overlapping centre-back, we've seen Arsenal do that with Kieran Tierney, we've seen Brighton do it with Dan Byrne. It seems like some of these things now have been adapted to, and Sheffield United haven't really got a plan B. And when you look around that squad, Doogie, I mean, it is really thin, right?
Really thin, really thin. And it's kind of weird. Like, now I look back on their season last year, I couldn't really say how they stayed up. You know, they were just like, they picked up points in crucial times. They went on a couple of reasonable runs. But, you know, an attack where is Dave McGoldrick, Lisa Musse, Ollie McBurney, and I'm missing the fourth striker, Callum Robinson last year. And you're just like, that attack is just not Premier League level. Throw in a sort of 19-year-old and Rian Brewster, who might even be 20, I'm not sure. But anyway, very young striker. And they've just really struggled. But they have lost a lot of games by one-goal margins. And it just feels like they need a win from somewhere to get some form of momentum going. But I just don't see where they go and what they do next as well. I personally wouldn't sack Chris Wilder. I'm not sure what there is really to gain from that, unless you're going to get in someone like Sam Allardyce. It's such a well-trodden route. But like, that sort of side would need someone like Sam Allardyce, and maybe he'd make them more solid. But I'm not sure which manager is going to get more out of those players in an attacking sense. So I'm kind of at a loss for Sheffield United, and I feel a bit sorry for their fans, to be honest. But, you know, the Championship isn't the worst division. They've had a lot of fun in the Championship in the past. They'll probably enjoy winning more games and maybe come back up next year.
Yeah, I think you've got to keep Chris Wilder. I think Chris Wilder is an exceptional manager for a team like Sheffield United. And if they were to get rid of him, I agree. I don't think they'd stay up. And if they were, and when they went down, I think they'd be in a worse position to rebuild. Like, I can't see somebody really getting more out of this squad. Like, it's kind of like West Brom, you know, where people have been saying, oh, well, Bilic has got to go. Look at their results. And I look at their squad and I think, what's the point of sacking Bilic? Like, I think they got promoted a little bit too early in a way. You know, I don't think they expected to get promoted that season. And you could argue the same about Sheffield United. So I don't know. I think that Chris Wilder will probably keep his job, but I think it's going to be a grim few months for Sheffield United fans. If there are any of you, then please let us know how you feel about the season in the comments. We'd be really intrigued if you've got an idea of what's gone wrong, because really it's only Jack O'Connell that's out long term, and it just feels like at the very least the defence should still be okay, but I don't know, everything's fallen apart in pretty spectacular fashion. Okay, we're going to end this week with a couple of quick headlines. Firstly, another team who were tipped for relegation, Fulham, got a really good result over the weekend, drawing with Liverpool, who have also had some bad news about Diogo Jota, who's ruled out for 6 to 8 weeks. Dukes, did you watch the Liverpool draw with Fulham?
I did.
Were you impressed?
I did. I was insanely impressed with Fulham, I've got to say. I thought they completely dominated, really, except for a stretch in the second half where, as you'd expect, Liverpool, you know, had most of the possession, most of the territory, most of the chances. But Fulham was so solid. I thought Anthony Robinson was excellent at left back. Thought Joachim Andersen was brilliant. Adebayo as well. And they controlled Liverpool really well, who I thought were far too passive. And I thought it was so much sideways passing. They really nullified Trent and Andy Robertson effectively. And it was a number of poor performances I've seen from Liverpool in the last month. Having thought about a month ago that they were going to walk the Premier League because of the level of their performances, if not their results. I just thought they looked by far the best side in the Premier League. They really struggled against Brighton. They drew against Midtjylland with their second team, played Diogo Jota in that game. He gets ruled out for 2 months, played Mo Salah the whole way through that game as well. He didn't look quite as sharp as usual on Sunday. And Fulham completely deserved the win, I would say, and fair play to them, because I feel like after the first three or four games, me and a lot of other, you know, people in football, whatever, the whole Football Daily team thought they're cut adrift, they're going to really struggle this year, but their signings have made a massive difference in defence. I think Loftus-Cheek started really well as well, and they've looked a lot better when Bobby Dekoldova-Reed has played up front instead of Mitrovic, who just didn't look quite at the races at the first part of this year as well. So things are really looking up for Fulham, and they've completely deserved this point.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that cost them really was bringing on Aboubakar Kamara in this game, who,
yeah,
is, oh God, I don't really know why he's paying for them at this point. At the same time, I did think it was a really harsh call, and I'm really kind of sick of the handball rule. Like, I mean, I know everyone says that, but it's like, when I watch a replay now of the ball hitting an arm, I feel like I'm not really sure what's going to be given. And I think we should all have an idea when we see a replay of whether it's going to be a penalty or not. You know, like, it does just feel like sometimes a ref will give it, sometimes they won't, sometimes they'll say, oh well, it looks like it might have hit above the sleeve. I feel like teams are just going to start making longer sleeves,
yeah,
or something. Like, it just I don't know, it just seemed really stupid, and it came out of absolutely nowhere as well. Like, the handball rule should be there to prevent teams getting a significant advantage, especially in their own penalty area. Like, when it hits somebody's hand when, like, the ball is going away from goal or something and nothing really is going to happen as a result, you know, or when it's going to hit somebody's body in anyway, it just feels like that is not what the handball rule is for. Like, should you be given, you know, an 80% chance of scoring a goal because somebody wants to cover their face because they're about to get hit in the head by a ball, especially given what we've seen recently about, you know, dementia in football from the ball hitting people in
absolutely
the head?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's a tough rule to swallow, the handball rule. And what you just want is, VAR, I think, is here to stay, but they make it so much harder for people to accept VAR with all its faults, which it does have a few, but it does also create a lot of, it's done a lot of good, VAR, I would say, as well. It's just, but it's really difficult to digest VAR and adjust to it if silly rules like the handball rule are being changed all the time and for the worse. Like, I don't think there was a massive issue with the handball rule a couple of years ago. And it feels like you're just not giving people you're just giving them an opportunity to just complain about VAR when actually it's the rules that people object to. And yes, it just frustrates me.
Yeah, I completely agree. But I think the rules need to be sorted out. And if they are, then VAR will become a secondary thing.
Yeah.
Let's move on then to La Liga, where we're going to end this week. Real Madrid beat Atletico Madrid over the weekend to put themselves back in contention for the title. Atleti now off the top of La Liga. On goals scored only, Real Sociedad back to top. Real 3 points off top spot, down in third. What did you think of this game, Dukes? Is there anything that we can take from this, or was it just one of these pretty drab Madrid derbies that we've got used to now?
It certainly wasn't exciting. Like, there wasn't much goalmouth action to either side, but judging from, I didn't actually watch the game, I only watched the highlights, but Real Madrid were definitely on top and fully deserved the win. Like, they started exceptionally well, they took that good momentum from that win against Sevilla last weekend, and then Gladbach in midweek started really well. I think Casemiro popped up with a very, very good headed goal as well. He's turning into quite a clutch goal scorer, to be honest. He got that amazing equaliser against Gladbach at the second match week, I think, of the Champions League as well, which saw them equalise in like the 93rd minute as well. So some important goals from Casemiro this term. And then Carvajal, such a sweet strike for the second one. And then it's just really unfortunate. Cannon's off the post, hits Oblak in the back and goes in. Lamar missed a great opportunity in the second half as well, just before that as well. So, I mean, Atleti created very, very little. I think there was, because I was writing this up for ERU, I think there was one, I think, of all their midfielders and attackers, I think only Marcus Llorente created a chance, which was that Lamar moment. No one else. And Luis Suarez, I think, had one shot. And I don't think João Felix had any. Like, Atleti were... I think they basically went there with the idea that they couldn't lose this game and kind of froze under some really good Real Madrid performances. I mean, Lucas Vazquez for Real Madrid in the last couple of weeks has been excellent. So not a massive amount you could take from this game. I was really surprised with the result because I just thought Atleti were going to go into this and just refuse to lose. But it just didn't materialise, and Real Madrid were probably worthy winners, but it wasn't the sort of game that's going to live long in the memory.
No, definitely not. I mean, Atleti, you would still argue, are in a very strong position. They're on 26 points, so Real Sociedad, but Sociedad have played 13, whereas Atleti have only played 11. Real Madrid are then 3 points back of them, and they've played 12. So technically, Atletico Madrid are in a pretty good position to push themselves ahead going into the winter break. But yeah, this just feels like a missed opportunity. But maybe Real Madrid finding a little bit of form again. Like you said, they've had a difficult week for fixtures, but they've come out of it with 3 wins. So very impressive stuff. And maybe Zidane is doing what actually he's done very consistently throughout his time as a manager, which is find a way to balance the side using the tools at his disposal. So an interesting one, this, but I'm not sure how significant it will be for the title race. I suppose we'll know in the space of a couple of months. So that's all we've got time for on this week's Extra Time. Doogie, thank you very much for joining me. Is there anything that you'd like us to point to before we say goodbye?
Yes, why don't you go check out the EFD Explained we dropped on Sunday on Eurofootball Daily's YouTube channel, where Pat broke down whether Wenger was underappreciated in comparison to Arteta. We managed to stay clear of Arsenal today, despite that horrendous result again against Burnley. So go check that out, because it's a great video.
Yeah, I think we're long overdue for a Wenger reappraisal. So check that out if you're interested in a little bit of Arsenal misery. And I think everybody is, really. Thank you guys very much for listening or watching. Please make sure that you subscribe to the podcast or subscribe to the podcast channel. Whichever ones you don't do already, please make sure that you sign up. Of course, make sure to head to manscaped.com and use that code EXTRATIME for 20% off and free shipping if you'd like to treat yourself to something over the new year. And hopefully we'll catch you next time. Bye.
Bye.